In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the Three Jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the Three Jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the Three Jewels. Whatever the virtues, the many fields of knowledge, all are steps in the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening, welcome. Great to see everyone. My recollection is that we stopped on page 55 with the header, The Way to Practice Shamatha. Sound good? Okay. We've all presumably read presentations by Trungpa Rinpoche and other teachers on shamatha. And this is a little summary of the traditional version of the practice. It has four parts: the way the eight applications produce mental stillness, which is the eight antidotes to the five obstacles, and the way to achieve mental stillness through nine stages, the famous nine stages of shamatha, the way those stages or states, those nine mental states, are achieved through the six strengths, and the way the four types of attention are involved in this process. So we have the eight antidotes that overcome the five obstacles through which one traverses through the nine stages, driven by the six powers, and one goes through the experience of four different levels of attentiveness during that process for the culmination of shamatha practice. On page 56, quoting from the earliest source, which is by Maitreya, one of the five dharmas of Maitreya, the differentiation, the middle and extremes, focusing on that diligence. The previous section of the text talked about the necessity of diligence for practice and developing flexibility, the pliancy. Suppleness that we read about last week, bring the achievement of all aims. So those two key factors, diligence and pliancy. This occurs from the cause of relying on the eight applications that eliminate five faults. So sort of summing them up into diligence and pliancy, all eight. Laziness, so these are the obstacles to shamatha, laziness, forgetting the instructions. Dullness and agitation, lack of application, and excessive application, too little, too much, are said to be the five faults. They are the basis, what is based on that, cause and results, not forgetting the object of meditation, recognition of dullness and agitation. So he's going through them in a sort of poetic way. So the basis is diligence. Based on that is flexibility. Causes and results are relying on the eight applications that eliminate the five faults. Starting with after laziness, which is primarily subdued by diligence and flexibility. Then not forgetting the object of meditation, which is basically the definition of mindfulness. Recognition of dullness and agitation, which is alertness. Active application to rejecting those. Actively applying mindfulness and alertness to reject dullness and agitation. So exertion and remaining naturally once there is pacification. So not applying the technique when not needed. So and results in equilibrium. The identification of the five faults and eight applications was presented above. We may ask, how is meditative concentration practiced through abandoning those faults with those applications? First, if the three types of laziness arise, which involve being disinterested in cultivating samadhi, is one, delighting in what is not conducive to it. So that's the description of laziness. You should arouse the three types of faith, which entails seeing the excellent qualities of samadhi and being enraptured by those excellent qualities and their results. Three types of laziness are sluggishness, lack of interest, and busyness. Interestingly, busyness is viewed as a type of laziness, just like doing things to avoid, like doing little things to avoid doing what we should be doing. You must have a strong, firm motivation that is highly focused and intent upon samadhi. So these are the four ways of overcoming the first obstacle, which is laziness. Three types of faith. Sorry, going back to the first one. So three types of faith is the first antidote. The second one is firm motivation, highly focused and intent. The third one is having considered the excellent qualities of samadhi, exerting yourself. So exertion, arouse great diligence, which is what the quote above started with. And by being willing to tolerate hardships when physical or mental weariness arise, you gradually develop physical and mental suppleness, which is another way of describing the flexibility or pliancy factor. So those four are the antidotes to the first obstacle, laziness. When placing your mind on an object of meditation, if you become distracted because you forget the instructions, which is the next obstacle, the fifth obstacle of the eight, arouse a strong stream of mindfulness. Bring your mind back to the object of meditation again and again and rest. At that time, while doing that, if the faults of dullness and agitation arise, we may have remembered the object and we bring our mind back to it over and over again, but our mind is dull. Our ability to experience the object is dim, is limited. Or we have a sense of the object, but we're agitated. Our mind is sort of all over the place. If the faults of dullness and or agitation arise, or you are afraid they will, so you anticipate this antidote, which is activate the watchfulness of alertness and recognize them. Alertness has these two domains. One is current dullness and agitation, and the propensity for dullness and agitation. Like if we feel like we're a little bit sleepy today when we meditate, as we sit down, we like do what we need to not let that increase in our meditation practice and occur. We can sort of feel like we have a propensity for dullness or agitation in advance of their occurrence. And when you were distracted by and the traditional analogy was like a sheriff. I'm not sure how traditional sheriffs are. They go back to the Wild West, right? So, but the image was of a peacekeeper in a village who, whenever the peace is broken by discord in the village, they are aware of it. They're constantly keeping track of that. And when they see it coming from a distance, they prepare for when you are distracted by dullness and agitation and are unable to apply yourself to the object of meditation or lack the energy to do so, arouse your exertion and diligence to clear away dullness and agitation by either tightening or relaxing, and then meditate. As the force of dullness and agitation diminishes, over-applying your mind will cause it to move. It's an odd phrase, over-applying your mind. It's really over-applying the antidotes, over-applying mindfulness, alertness, and exertion will cause your mind to be agitated, will cause your mind to move around. So the main three antidotes are mindfulness, alertness, and exertion. And exertion is similar to conscientiousness, which we saw earlier as one as the third factor of shamatha. So those are the three main antidotes. When that occurs, when the mind moves, remain in the equanimity of not applying your mind to anything. Be skillful in nurturing and sustaining that samadhi. This way of practicing shamatha is well known in most treatises on the stages of meditation, the esoteric instructions. Second, the way to achieve mental stillness through the nine stages, the ornament of the Mahayana Sutra says, after you have directed your mind to the object of meditation, do not be distracted from the continuity of that. That begins its description of the nine mental states of resting. And this is fairly standard and clear presentation. So let's see, I'm going to ask Mary Beth to read this for me. The nine stages.
Okay. Settling, completely draw in the mind that is not resting when it strays to and is distracted by externally appearing objects and so forth, and direct it inwardly to the object of meditation, as the text says. After you've directed your mind to an object of meditation, to continuous settling, without letting the mind that was initially directed towards an object of meditation be distracted to anything else, settle in prolonging the continuity of that concentration, as it says. Do not be distracted from the continuity of that. Three, renewed settling. If you are distracted by forgetfulness, recognize that and again apply your mind to its object of meditation. The text continues. Recognize distraction immediately and renew your focus on that object once again. Four, increased settling. Repeatedly withdraw your mind from broader diversions. As you refine your concentration, you settle more and more fluidly. It continues. More and more the wise draw their mind inward. Five, taming. By contemplating the excellent qualities of samadhi and dedicating yourself to achieving those, your mind is tamed. It continues. Then, seeing the virtues in this, your mind is tamed within samadhi. Six, pacification. Contemplating the disadvantages of distractions, any dislike of samadhi is pacified. The text continues. Because you see the faults of distraction, disinclination towards samadhi is pacified. Seven, full pacification. When faults in samadhi arise, such as attachment, unhappiness, sluggishness, or drowsiness. Pacify them with the appropriate methods. It continues. When attachment, unhappiness, and so forth arise, pacify them accordingly. 8. One-pointedness. By actively applying yourself to samadhi, you familiarize yourself with it so that later it arises continuously and without effort. The same text says, then those committed to their vows achieve a natural flow in their mind with active application. 9. Equipoise. After familiarizing yourself with the 8th mental state, your mind settles effortlessly, spontaneously, and naturally. You attain mastery. It concludes. Familiarity with that yields a lack of application. You're muted.
Great. Thank you very much, Mary Beth. So then we have the way those 9 mental states, which present a fairly succinct, smooth, ideal, idealized progression through the practice of shamatha from beginning to end. The way those are achieved through the 6 strengths, according to the teachings in the Shravaka Bhumi by Sangha on cultivating shamatha by means of the 6 strengths. The 6 are the strengths of hearing, reflection, mindfulness, alertness, diligence, and familiarization. Personally, I find these to be the most helpful way of understanding the progression of shamatha and what's helpful in shamatha. Hearing and reflection. So the strength of hearing produces the first mental state of settling because it enables you to settle your mind on an object of meditation simply by having heard from someone else about how to settle the mind on an object of meditation. So we receive instruction and we begin to apply it. The strength of reflection ensues the second mental state of continuous settling. It enables you to settle a bit more by extending the continuity of your concentration, since you repeatedly reflect upon and sustain your initial examination of the object of meditation. So here we've received instruction and we're applying the instructions and beginning to think about like why we're doing what we're doing, why use this technique, what are we meditating for, how are we meditating, how is it working, how is it not working, how do I focus on the object, and so forth. So we don't often talk about these stages, but I think this is a really helpful way of pointing out that before we actually can engage successfully in the practice, we really need to it helps to appreciate the early stages of the practice where we're trying to figure out the technique and how to apply it. What is the technique? It's not unusual to hear teachings, hear the presentation, the instructions on meditation, and not understand them correctly the first time. I think that does happen. People here and there, like 1 in a million, maybe, or maybe all of us. Like we hear instructions and the first time we hear them, we think we got them, but we find out later on that, oh, there was a nuance there that I didn't catch. And so it really helps to read more about the technique or talk more about the technique with your meditation instructor or with somebody or hear additional teachings on the technique. Understand why do we do the eyes open? Why do we have the out-breath only? Why do we have the posture and so forth? And that I think help is one of the most helpful things in being able to progress in the practice. The strength of mindfulness. So this is the antidote to forgetting the object. It yields the two mental states of renewed settling and increased settling. These are stages 3 and 4 of the 9. If you're distracted from the object of meditation, mindfulness will cause you to recollect that previous object of meditation. And this is a little nuance about mindfulness, as we saw earlier, that it's paying attention to something that we're familiar with. We've already encountered an object, and then we apply mindfulness to it. We remember it. We become familiar with it. If you're distracted from the object of meditation, sorry, will cause you to recollect that and draw your attention back. From the start, the force created by the strength of mindfulness prevents the mind from wandering from its object of meditation. So they often talk about the stake of mindfulness, just like really firmly planting the goal of mindfulness in our being as we practice. Let's see, the strength of alertness, which is the antidote for dullness and agitation, brings the achievement of the two mental states of taming and pacification, 5 and 6. And alertness is aware of thoughts and secondary mental afflictions as they arise. So, secondary mental afflictions is a list in the list of mental factors that does not include the primary kleshas of aggression, attachment, envy, pride, and doubt, but it includes lesser afflictions, which presumably when we're meditating, those are the type of afflictions that arise, as opposed to the very overt and overblown version of emotions in the form of kleshas. So recognizes these afflictions as they arise, and the mind pursues them. It's aware of the mind pursuing them. Alertness also sees their disadvantages and does not allow the mind to scatter. So we see that continuing to plague ourselves by going over things that didn't happen the way we want them to, things like that, don't really get us anywhere. The strength of diligence produces the two mental states of full pacification, 1.78. Because not tolerating even the smallest thought or secondary mental afflictions, it energetically eliminates them, and because it creates a continuous samadhi, not interrupted by dullness or agitation. The strength of familiarization results in the mental state of equipoise, the sixth power, because the strength of familiarization with and habituation to all of the above causes your mind to settle in a samadhi naturally and effortlessly. So the implication of the sixth strength is to harmonize strengths 3, 4, and 5, to harmonize mindfulness, alertness, and diligence, so that we don't have too much, we don't have too little, and that they work together. Mindfulness takes the lead, alertness provides the support, and diligence fuels the overall situation. And then equilibrium is the harmonizing of those factors. Let's see. Mary Beth, would you read the four types of attention that are involved in this process, please?
It is explained that four types of attention work with the above nine mental states of resting. They are attention that is tightly focused, attention that engages intermittently, attention that engages uninterruptedly, and attention that engages spontaneously. During the first two mental states, there is attention that is tightly focused, since it is necessary to strenuously tighten your concentration. Then, during the next five mental states, there is attention that engages intermittently, Since you are unable to sustain shamatha for a long time due to interruptions by dullness, agitation, and so forth. During that eighth mental state, there is a tension that engages uninterruptedly since you're able to sustain shamatha for a long time without being interrupted by dullness, agitation, and so forth. During the ninth mental state, there's a tension that engages spontaneously because samadhi flows naturally without the need for intense, continuous effort. The Shravaka Bhumi explains, be aware that the nine mental states of resting involve four types of attention. Attention that is tightly focused, attention that engages intermittently, attention that engages uninterruptedly, and attention that engages spontaneously. Settling and correct settling involves the attention that is tightly focused. Resetting, increased settling, taming, pacification, and thorough pacification involve the attention that engages intermittently. Creating a single continuum involves the attention that engages uninterruptedly. Engagement in samadhi involves the intention that engages effortlessly.
Thank you, Mary Beth. So here's some of the names for the nine mental states of resting are different from the ones used above. However, their essence is the same. We may wonder, since the first two mental states have attention that engages intermittently, and the middle five need attention that's tightly focused, why are the processes described as they are above? And he's addressing this concern that the description, one description seems to imply that attention goes from like a state of struggling to apply attention at the beginning to ultimately effortless effort or mental attention, and the other one seems to imply that attention is easier at the beginning and then gets more difficult in the middle. And he's saying, even though that is the case, it is thought that the term attention that is tightly focused is used for the first two, since they are predominantly when the mind is not inclined towards samadhi. The term attention that engages intermittently is used for the middle five, because they're there when the mind is mostly inclined towards samadhi. So attention that is tightly focused, that phrase really means attention that is forcefully applied in order to achieve the first two stages of the nine stages. We need to forcefully apply our attention. Now, we may not all have this idea of forceful. The word forceful is perhaps not something that we would think of, but there's an effortful quality at the beginning that one needs to apply in order to make progress in the practice. And attention barely succeeds in the early stages. And so it's said to be tightly focused only in the sense of it being tightly applied, and then attention engaging intermittently means that we're succeeding here and there, whereas in the earlier phase of attention tightly focused, we're not really succeeding. But then gradually we start to succeed in applying our attention, our mindfulness on the object here and there. We have experiences of connecting genuinely with the object of focus, i.e. the breath, generally, or the posture. And gradually that experience of connecting with the object in a steady, continuous way increases until finally becomes like a continuous experience. However, we're still applying effort to that attentiveness, and then finally it becomes effortless. When the mind becomes trained to do that, the mind becomes familiarized with it, habituated to doing that, and all we have to do is sit down and assume the posture and bring to mind the aspiration, and enter into the practice, and our attention becomes firmly focused on the object. When undertaking such samadhi, if you practice settling too often with a mixture of negative distractions, it will be difficult for you to achieve anything, even though you may practice for thousands of years. It is explained that the opposite of that is true. You will produce samadhi before very long if you rely on the aforementioned collection of causes, and without being interrupted by negative distractions, arouse continuous diligence. And the meaning of this is said to be that at the beginning, we should meditate in short sessions. I think we've all heard this as a common instruction in the Mahamudra tradition. So something like 24 minutes is sort of a traditional or common number of minutes in the tradition, trying to stay present and not go in for an hour to the point where our mind becomes mush for the last 20 minutes or so or whatever. And then we end meditation with a memory of meditation being mush-like. Like huskies in wet snow. But instead that we keep the sessions shorter initially until we have significant stability in the practice, and so we can have successful sessions and end with a positive feeling towards the practice and the next session. Now, this is not the tradition of Trungpa Rinpoche. Trungpa Rinpoche encouraged us to practice for long periods of time and was fine if we had mush or no mush, didn't matter in the beginning phases of meditation. And that was because he was doing a very different type of meditation practice at the beginning, the way he presented meditation. He was having us process internal baggage, process our internal, what this text calls secondary mental afflictions, by letting us experience them, going through the six realms, experiencing being carried about by our thoughts and emotions and habitual patterns, so that we get very familiar with them and we wear off the karmic momentum a little bit of those experiences. And so ideally, that's how we begin the practice, where we go to like nintuns or dhatuns, and there's long sessions, and we do struggle through it, and then we encounter Mahamudra at some point, and we say, oh, okay, now that I know how to practice, I'm going to do short sessions and build momentum in a correct type of practice, which is a very interesting distinction. The Lamp for the Path of Awakening by Atisha. And I had a problem with my charger. My charger was not properly connected, and my computer is about to run out of steam if I don't put the charger in at the same time. So I am going to put the charger in and take out the headset, and hopefully that will work okay. I have an old computer. I have to get a new one.
How's that? Is that viable? Good. Cool. Feels weird without my cocoon, though. And shamatha and its branches are impaired. So all the different categories. You may meditate with intense exertion for 1,000 years, but you will not produce any samadhi. In the synopsis of the Paramitas by Ashura says, with uninterrupted yoga, strive to produce meditative concentration. If you repeatedly slack off, fire will not appear from friction. And so this is a reference to the image of starting a fire. The shamatha is like starting a fire. Like you got to get some warmth going on, some friction, some intensity build up, some energy build up by really applying yourself. The next page, the process of yoga is the same. Do not stop until you reach what is exceptional. That's their form of encouragement. This completes the explanation of the way to cultivate samadhi. Sorry, shamatha. Many of you may be familiar with this, but there's a cool way of charting all the different factors of shamatha that we've been through, which
Derek?
Yes, sir.
I can't hear you as clearly as about a minute ago.
Yeah, I described that I have a problem with my computer and I'm going to need to speak without the headphones. So I'll try to speak as loud as possible.
That's better now.
Good. Derek, could you try turning off original sound and see if that helps a little?
Oh, I'm going to turn up the volume too. How's that? No? Where is the original sound? I was looking for it the other day.
It should be, I'm on my phone, so I can't see on computer, but it should be on the upper left-hand corner of your screen.
Oh, I have a note there that says original sound for musicians off.
That sounds good now to me.
You have it off?
Yeah, it says off.
Yeah, leave it off. Okay, leave it off. That should be good.
Okay,
but it does sound a little better now.
Okay, good. I'll try to rouse my energy and speak loudly for a change. And show you this cool chart. So here we have the obstacles, laziness, forgetting the instructions, so different terminology, elation, agitation, laxity, dullness, not applying the antidotes, and over-application of the antidotes. The eight antidotes, faith, aspiration, effort, suppleness, pliancy. Next one, so that overcomes laziness, those four, and then mindfulness, remembering to apply the instructions, overcomes forgetting them, awareness or introspection, in this text called alertness, overcomes agitation and dullness or elation, laxity, applying the antidotes is the antidote to not applying them, and then resting in equanimity is the antidote to over-application of the antidotes. The six powers, learning and contemplating, overcome these, the first obstacle and support the first four antidotes. Mindfulness tracks with mindfulness. Awareness or alertness, this Tibetan term sheshen, is what overcomes agitation and laxity. And there's coarse and subtle. Agitation and laxity. And when they divide things in finely in this scheme, they say that exertion helps overcome subtle agitation and dullness or elation and laxity, as well as helps one overcome not applying the antidotes and supports the application of the antidotes. And the thorough familiarity with all of the different aspects overcomes the over application and results in resting in equanimity. There's the nine stages. And then it's in the Mahamudra tradition called the practice tradition in most texts. We have this scheme that's called the five experiences. First, there's the experience of movement in meditation, like a waterfall. It's like we're in a waterfall and that thoughts, there's just a constant barrage of thoughts. In the early stages of meditation. After that, approach is the name for a fast moving river. We're no longer in a waterfall, but it's still like a lot of activity going on. And then familiarity is like a slow moving river. Stability is like a calm lake. And then perfection is like the ocean or like a mountain. Traditions differ slightly in how they present these. Three levels of the practice. Preparation is the first three stages. Actual meditation is stages 4 and 5. And then increasing meditation is stages 7 to 9 of the 9 stages. The three qualities we cultivate in the practice. Stability is cultivated with the first three powers, learning, contemplating, and mindfulness, cultivate stability. Alertness, awareness, introspection cultivates vividness or clarity, and exertion and familiarity cultivate strength in the practice. So these three are the main qualities of shamatha: stability, or stable, stillness, rather, vividness, clarity, knowing what's going on, and then strength, being able to pierce into the object that we're meditating on, pierce into whatever experience we're having, we can actually penetrate into it. And then the four mental applications we just went through, engaging through concentration, so a forceful version without much success, and then uninterruptedly, periodically, we're actually able to engage, and then we can engage uninterruptedly, and then we engage effortlessly. So that concludes a brief presentation of shamatha in what's called the shared tradition between the Sutrayana and the Vajrayana. So now we go into the fun part, Vipassana. Any comments before we launch into that? Okay. Sue?
Yeah. Is this an appropriate object of meditation?
Derek, I have a question.
Okay.
You know, if when I look at all these changes and characteristics, you know, I don't have a good way of knowing where I'm at in all this. You know what I mean? I mean, I think it's easy that I would delude myself or not even really know where I'm at in the stages. Were you able to hear that? You're muted, Derek.
Sorry, I was distracted by reading a chat. So I've been trying to encourage you to work with the six powers as the best way to gain a handle on the situation. Oh. And so focus on mindfulness. Am I forgetting the object? Am I actually able to remember the breath as I'm meditating? To what extent do I remember the breath? Do I come back and experience the breath? How much do I experience the breath in meditation practice? And our version is a little bit complicated because we focus on the out-breath and not the in-breath. So on the in-breath, you have to shift to the environment in your room and the posture. The posture, Rinpoche says at one point, is the universal reference point. So to what extent are you able to actually pay attention to the object of meditation as mindfulness? And then to what extent do you have dullness? Dullness is where your attention gets dim and it's not strong and clear. It lacks those three qualities of stability, clarity, and strength. In particular, stability and clarity. That's dullness. And then when you're experiencing agitation, we all know that. That's ranges from discursive mental activity to physical agitation, where we're uncomfortable, we're fidgeting around, right? We have itches, we're constantly shifting our position, we're blinking a lot, things like that. So those are pretty clear, I think, and easy to determine. And then the third one is energy. What is our energy level like in the practice? Are we sinking into a sand trap? Are we, we do talk about relaxation. We start with relaxation, but then we have to rouse our energy, rouse our life force. And without that, we're not going to be able to experience mindfulness and alertness. Mindfulness of being, you know, those two things. Mindfulness is being on the object, and alertness is, am I on the object in a vague way or like a scattered, interrupted way, or am I actually able to connect to the object genuinely? So I see it, those three factors being the main three factors, and it being like exertion is the foundation for the other two.
Yeah.
And exertion actually fuels the alertness. And the alertness supports the mindfulness. So it's sort of that hierarchy. And then the sixth power is just harmonizing those three, coordinating those three together. So really just those three factors, if you can focus on those three factors, you can understand them as stability. How stable is my meditation? How clear is it? Vividness, clarity. To what extent am I really aware of what's going on in my meditation practice? And then the third one is strength. To what extent am I able to stay present and really look at my experience, penetrate into my experience? So I think those three things out of all of these different lists are really the thing to focus on.
Thank you.
And in the chat, Debbie asked if I could circulate the chart, and I will do that. Thank you for asking. Was there anything else before we launch into Vipassana? Sue?
Well, don't you think that all of this is sort of natural? Like you could be trying to, you know, apply this or apply that or apply whatever, but that if you practice, this is sort of a description of what just kind of happens as you go along. That it's a natural kind of unfolding.
In my experience, it's only natural if you apply all of these instructions. The more natural thing is for one to fall into dullness and agitation, honestly. And to not understand the meditation instructions correctly. And to not understand why the eyes are open, the subtlety in the physical posture. I found that the influence or the impact of the physical posture took me many, many years to really appreciate the subtlety that of the energy that the correct physical posture creates. I think that is profound, and it's not, I didn't find that to be natural. I found that I learned to look into it by going through these courses over and over and over again and reading these texts and really beginning to appreciate the importance of it. Plus, there's a guy that writes these wonderful books on posture called Will Johnson. What is it? The Power of Balance, yeah. Balance of Meditation, a number of books by Will Johnson are quite good about that. And this whole issue of like, what am I focusing on during the in-breath? And then Vipassana, I think, is even more subtle, that I found required really reading lots of texts and trying to really figure out what was going on, because I think the instruction of panoramic awareness can easily lead towards hanging out in a state of dullness for a long, very long period of time. And I think that's what the quote that we went through was about, was that if you don't practice properly, you could do it for 1,000 years and not get anywhere. So I don't know about other people, but when you understand and apply all the factors, then it's a totally natural development.
Yeah, I mean, like if you just keep coming back to the instructions and trying to practice them.
Yeah.
So, but okay. Yeah. Thank you.
But the key is coming back to the instructions and rereading them, because I, you know, like me, the first time or the first 20 times I read them, I didn't get them right. So, Cynthia.
I was just curious in the, you know, in the way you described it, where you said that essentially the life force that which you were equating with exertion, I think, is that right? Kind of underlies and is really the first. And yet that is not the way it is taught. I mean, if you think about the overall way in which meditation is taught, everybody talks about mindfulness. We have, you know, it's nobody's talking about an exertion revolution. They're all talking about a mindfulness, you know, mainstream thing. And so I'm just curious. I think I'm not, I, I kind of agree in a sense that it's sort of the catch 22 of the whole thing is that if you can't keep mindfulness, if you know, then all the rest of it isn't going to happen. So that underlying.
I didn't say the first. I didn't say that's the first thing. I said that becomes the foundation.
Right, but isn't foundation in a sense?
No, I'm sorry to have expressed.
I don't mean necessarily chronologically. It isn't something that is typically presented all that much in the basic.
Well, it's the third antidote for laziness, diligence. So it is there right from the start. And in my experience, the only way to genuinely deal with, you know, alertness is said to recognize dullness and agitation, but it doesn't actually eliminate it. The recognition helps eliminate the coarse level of dullness and agitation, as the chart shows. But in order to eliminate the dull undercurrent of thoughts that's going on all the time, or the agitation, of that subtle agitation in the mind, you really need exertion. And so I apologize for implying that exertion comes first, but I think exertion makes the mindfulness and the alertness actually come to fruition.
Right. Yeah. I wasn't in any way critiquing what you said. I thought it was very good. It just struck me then that it's funny that given the significance and importance of that factor, it's interesting that it isn't as, it isn't the thing that most.
Why do you think that is?
Why do I think that is? Well, do we think it might turn people away? The idea of exertion is the, no.
I think you have to cultivate the awareness first. I'm just starting, like my posture, I recognize that's an indication of dullness. And how long have I been doing this? And it's all starting to come together. The words are coming together with the meditation. But in the beginning, I wouldn't have. You could say it 100 times and I wouldn't have gotten it.
Emily, thank you, Chris.
Isn't there also an idea that with us Westerners, we have exertion in overdrive, and so we need to chill out for a while before we can get there?
Totally. Totally. I firmly believe that that Westerners are overachievers, and we approach meditation like a project, and that we have to get over the sort of doing that is involved in our view of meditation, and sort of work through that phase, and then we can generate exertion again.
So do you think that it was presented differently in other cultures previously?
Oh, you can read the text. They do very much so, like in China and Japan and Korea, and in Tibet, they were like, practice, exert yourself, like these huge, like what we saw in Moonbeams, this book. Remember we were questioning Elizabeth about this at one point, like, why is the language so forceful? Do you remember that session where the language, like, exert yourself, like, rouse yourself and do it? And it was, she acknowledged that it seemed like Tibetans are very spaced out and relaxed, and they need to be incited, and that Westerners, it's pretty much the opposite. And that probably Indians are similar to Tibetans in that way.
Great. Well, thank you. What you were laid out was perfect. I just was trying to put it in this larger context and understand how it's instructed. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so let's dive into Vipassana. The way to cultivate Vipassana, so on page 63, there are two parts, the general way of cultivating and the way to generate the view for Vipassana. The general way is, rough, broadly speaking, there are three types of Vipassana. Mundane Vipassana, a lesser type of supramundane Vipassana, and Mahayana Vipassana, which is which the author doesn't say, but the implication is clearly that Mahayana Vipassana is a greater type of super mundane Vipassana. So mundane and super mundane refers to practices that will take you beyond the world or not. So a mundane practice gets you a better situation within the three realms of desire, form, and formlessness, whereas super mundane practices are ways to exit, take the exit off the highway of samsara. And there's the lesser type of that and the greater type, which is the Mahayana. The first is Vipassana that focuses on the aspects of calmness and coarseness. So I mentioned this earlier. Let's see. This is the type of Vipassana or insight into the subtleties of one's experience that someone who's practicing the absorption states would apply in order to go from shamatha into the absorption states, into the first absorption, and then from the first absorption to the second. And it involves identifying which qualities, which factors in one's mental and physical being are more coarse and which ones are more subtle or calm in each phase of the practice. And then one eliminates those which are more coarse in order to further enhance those qualities which are more calm, and thereby to progress from one level of absorption to the next. And so this is called mundane Vipassana because the absorptions on their own do not help one, do not result in exiting from samsara. They result in better and better experiences of situations within samsara. The middle is the Vipassana that focuses on the four truths. So the four truths, the noble ones, the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma teachings, what we might call Hinayana, with an emphasis on refuting a reputation, on the refuting a self of persons. Of the two types of self, there's persons and dharmas. This lesser super mundane practice focuses on refuting the self of persons. The latter is the Vipassana that is to be cultivated here, the latter being the greater super mundane or the Mahayana Vipassana, which will include refuting both the self of persons and a self of phenomena or dharma. Quoting from the sutra where the Buddha goes through these, the Vipassana that arises from characteristics is the prajna. So a sort of equivalence or a relationship or equating of Vipassana and prajna. The prajna that engages the characteristics of the objects, which is a preparatory phase of Vipassana. And then we have the Vipassana that arises from thorough investigation is the prajna that understands what was not understood about the abiding state of the view. And the Vipassana that arises from discernment is the prajna that is capable of liberation and is directed towards Dharma topics that were well understood. In other words, Dharma topics which one has heard, i.e. read or listened to, contemplated, reflected upon outside of meditation, and then within meditation, one then brings them into the object of one's Vipassana during meditation. So objects, topics that were well understood. So the author is quoting a scheme that's somewhat different from the scheme that was first presented. And we're going to see a lot of different schemes for Vipassana in this chapter, and it's going to get somewhat confusing. At the end of the day, we'll come up with one sort of system for Vipassana that it seems that all the presentations in the tradition settle upon realistically in practice. Then one may ask at that point, why did they present all these other different versions? And I think the response is that they help one understand the final version better, because the final version sort of includes and incorporates aspects of all the other versions within it. Let's see if that makes sense. The latter. The third one is cultivated once we have discovered the view of the definitive meaning. So this whole issue of cultivating the view, understanding the definitive meaning, the ultimate truth of the nature of reality outside of meditation practice, and then bringing that into meditation practice. And the idea that the cultivation of the view and the meditation go hand in hand. One doesn't just cultivate view, one doesn't just meditate, but one needs to do both. Again, unraveling the intent and Asangas, which is by the Buddha, and Asangas compendium of the Dharma, describe four types of Vipassana. So the author is going to go through all these different types of Vipassana. The Vipassana that differentiates phenomena is the prajna that focuses on quantitative phenomena by means of the objects of meditation for purifying behavior and the others. So this, let's see, that is the objects of meditation for expertise and for purifying mental afflictions. So if you remember the four objects, those are objects of meditation number 2, 3, and 4. If you remember when we went through them, the first one presented different ways of going through the remaining three. Bless you. So this is really the three different types of objects that one may take up in meditation practice, which basically are meditation subjects for transforming our state of being, such as loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, things like that, basically. So initially, Vipassana that differentiates phenomena is the prajna. This first one that focuses on quantitative phenomena. So quantitative phenomena are the way that the variety of relative phenomena manifest. Quantitative phenomena is a term that refers to the relative realm of existence. And this translator has a unique way of translating these two terms that are she's translated as quantitative and qualitative. And more common translations of these are the quantitative is usually translated as the variety or the extent of phenomena, the variety of the range of phenomena. And the qualitative is usually translated as the nature of phenomena. In other words, the empty nature of phenomena, the absence of the two types of self in phenomena. Here we have quantitative, the range or limit or extent of relative phenomena, and qualitative, in what way do they exist? Do they exist as truly existent? Do they exist as relatively existent, empty, dependent arisings? Is the conclusion of the view. So the view, cultivating the view entails understanding the relative and the ultimate levels of truth, the two truths. What is the ultimate truth? What is the relative truth? Secondly, the Vipassana that differentiates thoroughly, so again, differentiating, but a more thorough level, is the Vipassana that focuses on qualitative phenomena. So the first phase of Vipassana is understanding dependent arising, dependent origination. How do relative phenomena manifest? They manifest as dependent arisings. They're not independent. There's no independent phenomena. All phenomena are interdependent. They're made of parts, they're impermanent, and so forth. And then The second phase is understanding, well, what's the nature of all these phenomena? How do they exist? Do they exist as truly individual, separate entities that have their own essence? Or do they exist in a relative sense only as being empty of essence? The third one is the Vipassana that discerns completely. So not differentiates, but discerning is the prajna that differentiates, once again, coarse, qualitative, and quantitative objects by means of apprehending characteristics conceptually. So this is doing, analyzing, let's see, what's the word, discerning, differentiating both the nature and the extent of phenomena, the qualitative and quantitative aspects of phenomena conceptually by means of apprehending characteristics. The concept operates by distinguishing characteristics, color, shape, sound, size, up, down, past, present, and future. All of those are characteristics. Conceptuality operates by labeling these, by labeling fluid appearances as if they have these characteristics. So the third type of Vipassana is understanding that the process of conceptuality. Mary Beth.
Derek, once before we before we left the Shambhala Center, we did you gave a teaching on meditation, and we were in that room, and you led us through a guided meditation where we were supposed to identify, like, our mind, where it was, color, shape, things like that. That you guided us through, is that this, like, this number three? Is that kind of what we were doing?
It could be considered an aspect of that, that the mind is a phenomena, and to the extent we think of the mind as a discrete, separate phenomena, it's a quantitative analysis, and to the extent that we think it exists as by having an excuse me, by virtue of its own essence, it becomes a qualitative analysis also. And when we look at the self of persons and analyze the self of persons, in the traditional version of this begins with the body, where the Buddha and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra begins with the body and goes through all the different body parts, the postures of the body, the contents of the body, the elements in the body, the breath, and so forth. And then he progresses through feelings and then mind. And in the Mahamudra tradition, we skip the body and the feelings and we go directly to mind. And so I was focusing on that. I was following that tradition and focusing in on the mind, because ultimately we believe that the continuity of a person resides in our mind. When we all come down to it, we realize that the body is not me. We feel very much like my awareness is me. And so I did that contemplation, focusing on the awareness and seeing if we could identify the characteristics of that awareness that we felt made us able to identify the mind. How do we identify the mind? You know, so that sort of thing would be an example of this. Fourthly, the Vipassana that analyzes completely is the prajna that correctly differentiates subtle, qualitative, and quantitative objects. So these are analyzing non-conceptual aspect of our experience. So I think I mentioned last week that there is conceptual ignorance and non-conceptual ignorance. Conceptual ignorance is the belief in a self that we cultivate throughout our lifetime. Conceptual ignorance is believing that we're a man or a woman, or maybe we're neither, or we're old or young, or short or tall, have a certain hair color, things like that. We accumulate all sorts of different attributes of ourselves conceptually as we go through our lifetime. We have a profession, you know, who are you? And we immediately describe our profession. But the innate sense of self is a non-conceptual assumption. And so that's the subtle obstruction to omniscience. The subtle instruction to enlightenment is non-conceptual ignorance that is convinced that it is. And so that's worked with by the Vipassana that analyzes completely, correctly differentiating subtle, non-conceptual, qualitative and quantitative objects. The next, Sue.
So are you saying the non-conceptual ignorance, it's not based on characteristics, it's just this believing, keeping on being, thinking you are not.
Yeah, it's a presumption that's not supported by the facts.
Yeah, but you just keep doing it.
It's ingrained. It's programmed in us. The acquired or conceptual ignorance is much easier to work with
because yeah.
We can conceptually we can conceptually argue against it.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't make any sense that, you know, I'm not a human, I'm not a gender, I'm not a this or that. You know, that's not what makes me me. And I'm not my arm and my head, I'm not my emotions and so forth. But the other one is called, so they're called innate, is the non-conceptual ignorance. So all beings, all sentient beings are born with innate ignorance. Babies, mm-hmm. Animals, they all instantly have that when they're born. And then they develop conceptual ignorance as they go through their lives, developing an idea of who and what they are and how and why and so forth, self-importance and so mm-hmm. on.
Mm-hmm. The phenomena that we talk about as the seventh consciousness include both of those? Or is it more oriented to?
I think the seventh is more oriented towards the innate, but that's a good question. I'm not really sure if I've ever seen it localized in the scheme of the eighth consciousness. If I have to think about that,
it seems like there should be some correlation, but I'm not. I also have not seen that either. Thank you.
It seems like that would be the innate, the non-conceptual. Then we have another scheme. The Shravaka Bhumi teaches the Vipassana of six categories. So just to review, if you go back a page, we had a scheme of three types of Vipassana. Then we have a scheme of four types of Vipassana. And by the way, the four types of Vipassana is what Trungpa Rinpoche goes through in the, it's now in the Profound Treasury, chapters 47. He goes through the four types of Vipassana, and he talks about if a pterodactyl landed in your lap, something like that is one of the examples, I believe. He gives a very interesting presentation of these four that doesn't really bear much resemblance on the surface to this presentation. And then there's the Vipassana of six categories, and Trungpa Rinpoche goes through that, I believe, in chapter 48, where he calls them the six discoveries. So he goes through those as well. The Shravaka Bhumi teaches those six categories, which it says contain all forms of Vipassana, are the investigation of 1, meaning, 2, entities, characteristics, 3, qualities, time, and reasoning. The point is that they are modes of inquiry for the Vipassana that arises from thorough investigation. So the Vipassana that arises from thorough investigation, if you go back to the second page before, that's the second page, type of the three types of Vipassana, gives rise to these six modes of inquiry, or six objects of the mode of inquiry from that Vipassana. And so these seem more like a sort of fruitional level of Vipassana, like what Vipassana results in being able to understand what is meaning as opposed to words or sound. You know, how do we derive meaning from sounds? What is that process? What are things? What are entities? What is a thing? We have general things are conceptual ideas, groups, like a forest is a conceptual idea. And then there's a tree, it's said to be an individual thing. Characteristics are the whole way that phenomena are distinguishable by virtue of characteristics of color, shape, size, and so forth, so on and so forth. Qualities are usually said to be to what extent does a certain activity or phenomena support one's path towards enlightenment, or be an agent against one's progress on the path. And then time is understanding the three times: what's the past, the present, and the future, and in what way does the past impact the present and the future, even though the past is gone? How does that work? And then reasoning, and this involves using logical reasoning based upon fact. Reasoning in Buddhism starts with fact, which is a slippery slope, but it's defined as the valid ascertainment by non-conceptual cognition, which means the senses. And it's really based on consensus, like we all see something as red, but we know that there's people who are colorblind that see the color red as a different color. And so what is actually the correct color in that case? But we say that the red is the valid answer because it's the majority. So logic has a certain limited extent of applicability, where it works up to a certain point and then logic falls apart. But they don't emphasize the falling apart part here. They emphasize the importance of logic, and logic is very helpful on the path. And the fundamental logic is that for some reason we're all interested in Buddhism and meditation. And why is that? What's the logic of that? Why are we interested in Buddhism and meditation? Is there somebody that has made us do that? Or do we think it looks cool, or is fun or entertaining? Or do we think somehow it's going to support my development as a human being, potentially to enlightenment? So what's the logic of that? What is the logic that we all have for thinking that enlightenment is possible? So that's that sixth topic explores reasoning, focused upon primarily that issue. Sue.
Could you just review about the entities one?
Sure. So entities are of two types. There's what we call general, what we call conceptualized entities, ideas. There's a forest is an idea. A forest is a grouping of trees. And when you encounter a forest, you can tell that it's an idea because you can't really determine where it begins and where it ends. You know, when you're in the middle of the forest, you're in the forest, but at the edge of the forest, it's like, is that tree in the forest or outside the forest? How far away are the trees? at the edge of the forest where they're no longer in the forest. You know, it totally, there's no way of distinguishing that. So that's a good indication that it's a general conceptual idea. Whereas the trees, from this point of view, are initially held to be a specific, what's called specifically characterized phenomena, that they have non-conceptual existence outside of our perception and labeling process. Forests exist only in our mind. Trees
specifically, exist. Say it again, specifically.
Yeah, so there's this technical language of specifically characterized phenomena and generally characterized phenomena.
Thank you.
So let's see. The point is that they are modes of inquiry for the Vipassana that arises from thorough investigation. And I think I have enough juice to end the class with a headset here. Also, the limit for the Mahayana
by Maitreya says using mental expressions, i.e. meaning, continuously investigate and examine without the expressions of attention, analyze with one taste. I don't know that. I guess is a general way of characterizing those, perhaps. It's a little unclear. Vasubandhu's text called An Explanation for the Ornament of the Mahayana Sutras, the commentary on Maitreya's text, discusses 11 modes of Vipassana. So here's like another scheme for Vipassana in the traditional sources. And his text says the four verses, beginning with using mental expressions, the one quoted just above, he's going to continue upon that. So he's implying that the stanza from the ornament lists the first few of the 11. He says, beginning with using mental expressions, presents those four verses. We only saw the first of those four, present 11 types of attentiveness, that which involves conceptuality and analysis, that which is only analysis without conceptuality, which is like the fourth type of Vipassana on the page before that analyzes correctly, subtle phenomena. That which is only analysis without conceptuality, that which involves neither conceptuality nor analysis, which sounds like Trungpa Rinpoche's type of Vipassana, steady, panoramic. And let's see, attentiveness to shamatha, so Vipassana that focuses on shamatha, attentiveness to Vipassana, no idea what that means. Vipassana, that is attentiveness to Vipassana. Attentiveness to the unification. Attentiveness with the characteristics of concentration, with the characteristics of shamatha, of equanimity, constant attentiveness, and devoted attentiveness. So these guys clearly have a predilection for just coming up with many different lists to confuse us. So I wouldn't let them confuse us. Let's not let them confuse us and not fixate on these. However, if you're at all familiar with the teachings of Kenpo Tsultrum Gyamso, he goes through these 11 categories of attentiveness in his commentary on the Ocean of Definitive Meaning by the ninth Karmapa, who presents them as well. After the quote, the author says those 11 modes of Vipassana are a comprehensive presentation of Vipassana. The first are concerned with the investigation of the view, the middle with meditation on the view, and the latter with the Vipassana that is directed towards the view. So the first are concerned with investigation of the view, cultivating the view. The view of what? The view of the true nature and extent of phenomena. Those two ways of looking at reality. Nature, what is the nature of phenomena? Their emptiness. And extent, how do phenomena manifest causes and conditions? Interdependent arising. And then the middle with meditation on that view. So cultivating the view through meditation. And the latter with vipassana that is directed towards the view. So presumably the middle ones are more shamatha type and the latter ones are more vipassana type, in this context more analytical meditations. To summarize, the sutras and texts on the stages of meditation use the analogy of fire arising from the friction of two sticks to demonstrate the necessity of the prajna of discernment and analysis during the preparatory phase of vipassana, and the analogy of the fire and the sticks burning up and disappearing in the end to show that there is no object of meditation for discernment, because phenomena are empty of characteristics from their own side. We project characteristics onto them, so there are no objects. To show that there is no object of meditation for discernment, analysis, and so forth. So we analyze to the point where the object of analysis disappears. This is during the actual practice of vipassana. So he's also suddenly entered into the arena, a scheme of two types of vipassana called preparatory phase of vipassana and actual phase of vipassana. And the preparatory phase of vipassana is analytical, discursive, investigating, differentiating, and the actual practice of vipassana is unmoving, non-conceptual, unflinching. And the terminology of preparatory and actual, I think we should be very careful not to be fooled into thinking that the preparatory phase of vipassana is like sort of short, and that the actual phase of vipassana then goes on for a very long time. If you need to practice actual vipassana for a very long time, then you're not actually practicing actual vipassana. In other words, the preparatory phase, in our language, preparatory means sort of like a quick and early, and you get through it. I think that's highly misleading, and it's more like, this is like what we cultivate over the long term, this phase of vipassana that's involves analysis and inquiry, investigation, and then periodically and sporadically we experience actual vipassana, where we've understood the import of emptiness and we're able to gain little glimpses of not having a conceptual framework going on in our being here and there. That is also explained in the instructions on Madhyamaka by the great Lord Atisha, and this is a short text by Atisha, the Madhyamaka Upadesha, that those of us in the Rime Shedra classes before have seen in numerous courses that we've done. And the author, there's a translation of most of that text, we'll come to it soon. Thus, giving rise to the view is essential to the process of cultivating vipassana. So view and meditation going together. Cynthia.
I just wondered, in these stages, how do they or do they not relate in any way to hearing, contemplating, and meditating, or the notion of, it seems like there's a quality of the preparatory phases as being kind of like hearing and contemplating, investigating and all of that, and then the final step of sort of letting go of that and just working with the experience. Is there any relationship at all, or are these totally different schemas?
Oh, they are necessarily very relatable. They have to be, because prajna is cultivated by vipassana through these three stages of hearing or studying, contemplating, reflecting, and then meditating upon informal meditation practice, meaning equipoise and post-meditative attainment, which is a technical term that, for our intents and purposes, is another part of the meditation practice, not the post-meditation practice. But this depends on the tradition. If you're in the Gelugpa tradition, you will spend a very long period of time with hearing and contemplating outside of formal meditation practice, investigating and analyzing and differentiating all of the qualitative and quantitative phenomena, the way things are and the way they manifest, the extent of and variety of appearances and the relative level of reality and the nature of phenomena as empty and the ultimate level of reality. So one will do a lot of that outside of meditation and bring into meditation the essence of what one has concluded in one study, which in the Gelugpa tradition, the whole scheme revolves around identifying understanding the meditation on emptiness to be a process of identifying opposite of emptiness as the object, what's called the object of a negation. The opposite of emptiness is essence or self-essence, self-nature, and then negating self-nature as being impossible. And then one would experience have the experience of not finding things to be existent in the way that one's innate and acquired ignorance thinks they are existent within the meditation practice. In the Kagyu Enigma practicing traditions, there's a lesser emphasis on hearing and contemplating outside of meditation, but it's only lesser, and I think that in the West there's become an incorrect idea that one doesn't need to do extensive study, and that meditation is really the most important thing. Meditation is, but without extensive study, meditation does not become Vipassana of the super mundane type, Mahayana world transcending Vipassana. So there needs to be some balance, and we see even within Trungpa Rinpoche's presentation, so we take his presentation as being sort of tailored for us, and while on the one hand he presents panoramic awareness, and he states that the practice tradition is not the scholarly tradition, does not focus on scholarly analysis, but instead focuses on the yogi methodology of prioritizing meditation. At the same time, Trungpa Rinpoche gives numerous Dharma talks on understanding ego, understanding the self, understanding the skandhas and ayatanas and dhatus and the six realms, and the portable stage set and the emotions and all of these things. And that's his version of hearing and contemplating outside of meditation, is talking to us about what is ego and what is emptiness, teachings on those outside of meditation, and then bringing into meditation the experience of not conceptualizing things one way or another. Portable stage set. Tara, Eric read a reading from Trungpa Rinpoche about that last week. It was in this book called The Path is the Goal. And I circulated some excerpts from that book that included, that did not have the portable stage set. It was a different section. But Eric read this one section where he describes how we begin in meditation practice, we begin to become aware of our ego as that show that we bring along with us wherever we go. We put on our personal show of whoever we are. Yeah, so I'll send you that. I'll send out the portable stage set because it's really wonderful and you haven't seen that. So I'll send that out subsequently. He then presents panoramic awareness, which is very much like this actual practice of Vipassana, but he doesn't really clarify very strongly that that's a very advanced stage of Vipassana. He does in the two excerpts that I presented from The Path is the Goal, he says in both of them, he describes awareness and the expansion of awareness into panoramic awareness. And then he concludes by saying, this is just the very beginning part of Vipassana practice, right? And so here, actual Vipassana is not the beginning. Actual Vipassana is like the conclusion. So we have to then think about, is his panoramic awareness the same as actual Vipassana, or is it maybe different? And maybe it's both. Maybe sometimes it's the part of the preparatory phase, and maybe here and there it's part of the actual Vipassana. In my opinion, there are places where he talks about Vipassana, the panoramic awareness, as leading to an understanding that there's no agent, there's no reference point. There's this one place he talks about radiation without a radiator. And we're able to see that with the setup of panoramic awareness. So in that case, it sounds very much like the actual Vipassana. So it's a fascinating project of trying to compare the two approaches and understand what he was doing. And if you're really interested in that, there's a course on the Rime Shedra website where we went through a comparison of his presentation of Shamatha Vipassana with that given by Jamgon Kongchol in his Treasury of Knowledge, which is the textbook that Trungpa Rinpoche used as his source for the seminary teachings, along with numerous other classical sources. And I've compiled those classical sources and this document that this is taken from is that, and I'll share that. So we have all these other versions of texts where they go through the three Vipassanas and the four Vipassanas and the six Vipassanas and so forth. And it helps flesh out these otherwise rather cryptic explanations of Vipassana. So I'll share that. In that, we should bring this to conclusion, given that it's a little bit past our end time. And it's a perfect segue into the discussion of the fact that, let's see, we're on tonight is class 8, is it? Something like that. And we have originally scheduled, tonight is class 8, and we were supposed to go to page 71, and we're on page, where are we? Page 65. So let's see, we made it.
Halfway.
How many pages did we go tonight?
Yeah. We made it, we started at 55, so 10.
Okay, good. 10 pages. So we're going slowly and carefully and thoroughly through this, which I don't know about you guys, but I find more fun. And I would be of the opinion of extending the course, as I've done with many of these courses. Those of you who are new, these courses tend to go on way past the original number. And we'll just take it until we finish this part of the material that's outlined in this current segment, finishing up with Vipassana, and then this section called Removing Doubts about How to Sustain Meditation on the View, where the author goes through some of these, some comparisons of these different types of Vipassana with other traditions. It's quite interesting. And so I would be in favor of just continuing to go through at this speed and finish this, and then we can talk about the next segment of this, whether to go right into, have a like a 1 week break and then go into the next segment of this book if people are interested, or to I'll launch into something else more obscure and nerdy. Dep- depending on what people are, you know, if people want to continue with this, we should, I would be in favor of that. Comments? Thumbs up?
I want to say thank you. I mean, this was very, very interesting. Thank you for going through these six, the four and the six. And
it's neat to look at Trungpa Rinpoche's version of these and other versions of them. I circulated a version tonight before class by Shamar Rinpoche, right, where he goes through the three, the four, and the six. And so you can read that at your leisure. And that is one small part of that large source book that I just showed, which happens to be some unbelievable number of pages of 307 pages. So, any other comments, questions, suggestions before we end, Barbara?
No, I have nothing to compare this translation to, but I think it's really good somehow, because even though the material is still, it's you have to work with it a lot, but the sentences kind of are. What do you think?
It's clear. It's so good. It's so good. It's so clear, so readable, and so it's so accessible. I personally would wish for more things about it, like I found he names a text called Instructions on Madhyamaka. So in order to find out who the author of that is, you have to go through the bibliography author by author to find that text. That's a tiny little shortcoming. But generally, in particular, compared to the older translation, this is a really helpful, amazingly helpful, yeah. Should we conclude? Oops. Let's try this one more time. There it is. The chance. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to see you all. Take care.
Bye-bye.
See you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.